Tonight on Arena, we preview Hugh Lane, Sarah Green and an all-star cast in the BBC's Roadkill, and John O'Connor on the final piano sonatas of Ludwig van Beethoven. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. This year, 2020, we mark the 250th anniversary of composer Ludwig van Beethoven's birth, and as part of the year-long celebration, Music for Galway will stage a special concert tomorrow featuring the renowned pianist John O'Connor performing the composer's final three piano sonatas. These works were to be performed before a live audience in Galway, but given the world in which we now live, the performance will be streamed live from the concert venue in the centre of Galway City tomorrow evening. And delighted to say that I'm joined by John O'Connor now from our Galway studio. Strange times that we live in, for sure, John. Were you disappointed when you heard that it was going to be streamed rather than with an audience there in front of you?
Well, to be quite honest, I mean, I haven't done a live concert. I haven't done any concert since the beginning of March. So this is the first concert I'm giving. I'm giving three concerts in Ireland: Galway tomorrow night, and Drogheda on Friday, and Belfast next week. And it's a relief to be actually playing to anything at all, even if the people are not sitting in the audience, because it's been an incredibly depressing time. Mm. I mean, as you saw, one concert after another being cancelled, and not a single one. I mean, I should have been giving about, I think, 65 concerts this year of Beethoven, and I've had nothing since March, as I say.
It's so difficult to deal with. And I mean, we've spoken to so many artists about this. But I guess, you know, I do wonder to a certain extent, John, about if you're streaming it live, if you have to play it in front of a live audience, albeit not sitting in the auditorium in front of you, but out there, it's not as if you can fluff something and say, ah, no, I'll just go back in that little bit. You still have to do what you would do in a live situation.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it's the pressure's on you. I mean, you're playing to one cameraman, I think. That's about it. I'm not even sure. I haven't done any of these before. So tomorrow night will be my first experience. But I believe it's just one cameraman in the room. And so you're playing to him. So you just hope that he's receptive and doesn't go for a smoke in the middle of it or something like that.
There might be a few people watching what the cameraman is sending out to us as well.
That'd be nice.
I would guess. The final three piano sonatas of Beethoven is what you're giving us tomorrow night, John. We have 32 in total. When he comes to those final three, what has he managed to achieve across, never mind all the other work he's done, but just that body of piano works?
I studied with the great German pianist Wilhelm Kempff, and when he did his course in the summer, he would start at the very beginning, the first sonata, Opus 2, number 1, and go straight through chronologically to the last three. And you suddenly realise for the first time what he did achieve. I mean, from being, you know, almost the student of Haydn and in the same sort of style of Haydn and Mozart, even though he was already developing his own voice, as it were. But what he achieved through his whole life and how the pianos changed in his lifetime. I mean, when Haydn was writing, it was still the harpsichord or the forte pianos. Mm. And for the beginning, Beethoven had the forte pianos, and his piano wasn't as wide as it is now. Now we have 88 keys, he had about 65. And all the time he railed against the pianos and saying they weren't good enough. So he would love the modern day Steinway. And yeah. He was already composing sort of, you know, by the time certainly he got to the last three sonatas, he was composing for the piano that would appear eventually, which we now have.
And I guess it's one of the big differences there. Obviously, I suppose the resonance of the instrument has changed. But one of the big things that is the name itself, piano forte, you can now, the dynamics, the loudness, the softness, you can play much more in a much more graduated fashion than you could have done on earlier pianos or in Beethoven's time.
Absolutely. And I mean, I remember being in the Beethoven house in Bonn and being allowed to play the piano that he actually composed the Waldstein Sonata on. And it was so light and it was so easy. I mean, there's the end of the Waldstein Sonata, you're supposed to glissando with the thumb and fifth finger, which in a modern day piano can almost break your fingers because they're so difficult to get down. But in those days, you could just slide down them and they were the easiest thing. But so life has changed a lot for us pianists, but we're not complaining. It's great pianos we have now.
Yeah, and I suppose what you lose in the roundabouts, you gain on the swings. And if you have a sore finger, you have a much nicer sound for the sore finger.
That's true. And more variety too.
Yeah, absolutely. When did you actually first perform Beethoven, John? Can you remember back to that first public performance?
First public performance, my goodness. I would have been about 16 or 17. Mm. I studied with Dr. J.J. O'Reilly in the College of Music in Dublin. He was a great teacher and a great inspirer. He talked about dreams, about how you could walk on stage and do concerts. And I believed all the dreams. And, you know, it happened for me. But, I mean, when I was about 16 or 17, he said to me, "You're ready now to play your first Beethoven sonata." And very cleverly, he gave me a very slim book about Beethoven's life. He said, "If you want to play Beethoven, you need to know the man." And there was a story in that I remember which just attracted me so much to the man in a certain peculiar way, in the sense that I was a well brought up Dublin boy. I mean, my father made me stand up for ladies in a bus and open the doors for ladies and all that sort of thing. And there was a story in it of Beethoven and Goethe walking in the Mödling outside Vienna, and the imperial party came along with all these princesses in their long dresses. So Goethe stepped into the dirty road so that the princess dresses wouldn't get dirty, and Beethoven walked straight through them and said, "My genius bows to no man." And I remember reading that and thinking, that's disgraceful, that's disgusting, that's awful. And yet it was sort of, that's kind of interesting. So I had to know more about him. So I did read more and I played a lot more and that sort of thing, which brought me to him more and more. I mean, I was about 10 when I heard my elder sister Carmel was doing her teaching diploma, and she played the Opus 110 sonata, the second last sonata. And I just fell in love with the slow movement. It was one of the most tragic musical moments I'd ever heard in my life. And even though it was written in six flats, which is very difficult to sight read, particularly for a 10-year-old, I had to sit down and try and struggle through it, because it just touched my heart and it was just amazing. And
you're telling me that as a 10-year-old you had a go at sonata number 31.
Only the bits I could vaguely play. I mean, most of it I couldn't get around at all. But those bits I could play, I had a go at. I had to.
Let's have a little listen to the opening section of sonata number 31, A flat major, all those flats, as you say. The performer here is Stephen Osborne. So delicate, I'm almost afraid to talk over it. Just the opening section there of the sonata number 31 in A flat major, one of the three pieces that John O'Connor will be performing tomorrow as part of Music for Galway. You get a sense listening to that, John, just how delicate. There's a real sense of introspection, a real sadness actually in even that opening section, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. And it's like he's searching for a key. I mean, he's going through all sorts of different keys. He's searching for something, and it moves on and on. And then this incredible melody comes in the right hand, which is, as I say, heartbreaking. It's just extraordinary.
You mentioned that, you know, getting to know the man, even as when you started out with one of those, I presume, early sonatas that you were given by your teacher, but maybe not. Maybe it was a later one, but I would guess it was an early one.
Yeah.
That you wanted to learn more about the man. Now, tomorrow's concert, and in fact, there's a symposium as well, is in memory of Emily Anderson, a professor of German in NUI Galway. She translated some of the letters of Beethoven. Are there things that he says in there and things that you find from her writings that have opened up these late sonatas, these final three sonatas, in new ways to you?
Yes, I mean, just reading his life at this part of his life, how difficult it was for him. I mean, well, you have to realise with Beethoven's life, he set out to become the greatest pianist in the world. And in his 20s, he probably was. And then he started losing his hearing. So by the age of 30, he realised he was going deaf, which for any musician is just a death knell. I mean, and when he was 32, he wrote what's called now the Heiligenstadt Testament, which was basically a suicide note. Fortunately, he didn't send it, and it wasn't discovered until after he died. But it was basically saying, you know, what am I doing on this life? What is this life if I can't have music? And then he had a great belief in the Almighty. He realised, you know, if God put me on this earth for a reason, obviously it's not to become the greatest pianist in the world. Maybe it's the greatest composer, or certainly to compose more. So he composed more and more and more all the way through his life. And when you read his letters, you realise the anguish he was going through in so many ways. I mean, all sorts of things that were in his life that make you realise that when you hear music like the Opus 110, that it's his heart coming straight out onto the music, and has to, you have to actually go beyond what's written on the page to understand what it was coming from. In other words, how he heard it in his head, even though he couldn't hear it in person, even.
And I guess that's all work, that's work that you could do since last March, because you weren't playing in public. All that work has to be really, I suppose, absorbed into the head well before any concerts and anything like that. And then you just let it filter through rather than trying to actively put it into play on certain phrases or notes or anything like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been playing the Opus 110. It was part of my programme when I won the Beethoven competition in 1973, which is almost 50 years ago now. So I sort of know it pretty well. But,
yes.
You know, it constantly at the same time, every time you play it, you can find something new. You never get tired of Beethoven. You never do, because there's so much in there. If you listen to it in a different way, in a different place, and at a different time, you'll hear something that you've never heard before.
And you've recorded all 32 of the sonatas, of course. Have you ever performed them in, you know, the sort of chronology that you spoke about, that your early teachers talked to you about, you know, going through the sonatas in that order, what you see? Have you performed them in a way that has opened up the chronology of them and how you see that development, or does that just come from 50 years of playing them?
No, the first time I did the complete cycle was in the National Concert Hall in Dublin in 84-85, and I did them all 32 in the season. And then after that, I did them in New York and in Boston in 89, and then I've played them quite a few times since then. I did them again in the National Concert Hall in 2004-2005, and it was funny, at that stage I said to Judy Woodworth, who was the head of the National Concert Hall at the time, I said, Judy, I know these pieces so well, I want to talk about them before I play the programme and just give hints so people can understand them better. And she said, fine, when will you do it, a week beforehand? And I said, no, I'd like to talk at 7 o'clock, take a break at 7:30 and then play the concert at 8. She said, oh, you'd be too tired. And I said, that's what I want to do. So she said, all right, I don't think many people will come, but however. So the first concert, you know, she called me a week beforehand and said, well, OK, I thought we would have it in the director's salon, which can take 80 people, but we've already got 150 people signed up. So can we do it in the main concert hall? And I said, sure. So for the first recital, there were 8 recitals in all. Hmm. For the first recital, there were about 250 people there. And then suddenly word got out. And by the time I was doing the 8th recital, there were over 700 people in the hall at 7 o'clock to hear me talking. And about a week later, I was walking down Kildare Street in Dublin, and a man stopped me and said, John O'Connor. And I thought, oh gosh, somebody else whose face I don't recognise anymore. And I'm terrible at remembering people's names. I'll talk to anybody if they reintroduce themselves. But anyway, he said, it's all right, you don't know me, but I was at your concert, I was at your lectures. I only discovered them for the third time. And he talked to me for about 15 minutes about the lectures and how wonderful it was and how it opened his mind to Beethoven more. And I said, great. And he was turning away to go away. And I said to him, how was the playing? And he said, oh, that was fine. And then he just turned around and left.
But I'm really surprised to hear that you, as I'm sure Judy Woodward was as well, that you had agreed to speak before playing. Surely the type of pressure that you're under when you're performing pieces of this magnitude, it's phenomenal to take time out to have a chat with the audience beforehand. Or did that help you getting into the pieces?
I think it helped me, and I think it helped them. And remember, I've been playing these pieces for 50 years. So,
yeah.
I mean, they're old friends at this stage. And I like to share, I mean, the people will know some of the sonatas very well, like the Moonlight or the Pathetique, which are very famous. But there are a lot of sonatas that they won't know at all. And I want to say, listen for this and listen for this and wait till you hear how he does this and that sort of thing, which people find kept on coming up to me after and saying, that was fascinating. I've never loved that sonata before. I'm going out to get a recording of it tomorrow.
Yeah, and you'll be talking with Finian Collins about the sonatas tomorrow. But I think that's after the event, isn't it?
Yes, yes, we're doing a talk. Well, we're doing a symposium first, and then we have a 45-minute talk, Finian and I, about Beethoven. And then after the recital, I'm doing a question and answers with him.
Oh, so all of the symposium and the chat will be beforehand, and then the recital, and then the Q&A after the event. Well, of course,
yeah.
people can ask questions, I suppose. Having listened, they can ask questions about what they've just been listening to. What about the sonatas versus the concerti? The Beethoven piano concertos are pretty important as well. Which of your children do you like better? Is that the question I'm asking here, or which are better, apples or oranges?
And well, that's a little bit that way, yes. I mean, people often ask me which one, and I sometimes say, you know, the one I'm playing at the time, because you love it. But I suppose my favourite of all the concertos is number 3, and then number 5. But at the same time, number 4 has a special place in my heart because it's what I played at the final of the Beethoven competition when I won first prize, which really started my international career. So that has something very special for me.
Piano. Piano composition, there were other concerti as well, obviously, for violin in particular. There, we have the string quartets and we have the big symphonies. What could Beethoven not do?
He wasn't a great composer for voice. He was great for instrumentalists of all sorts, but he sometimes forgot the fact that singers have to actually not sing the high notes non-stop. So I remember talking to one girl who could actually sing the soprano part of the Ninth Symphony really well until it got to a certain place where she said, he leaves you hanging up there on the top notes for so long, your voice just cracks after a while sometimes. So you have to be very, very careful. So, you know, he wrote some beautiful songs, there's no doubt about it. But he wasn't as good, let's say, as Schubert or Schumann or Brahms or something, one of those, at voice.
Of course, and there was only one opera in there as well, which I suppose tells its own story as well. Well, listen, John, lovely to speak with you this evening, and lovely that you are getting back on stage tomorrow, albeit in that that there won't be an audience there, but there will be out in the ether, believe me.
That's the
way we work every night. You know, they are there and they will be listening.
Well, it's all available on the Music for Galway website. They'll know exactly how to clock in.
Yeah, well, listen, I'll give the full information on that
in a couple of minutes'
time.
That's very good of you.
Thanks, John. But let's finish up by listening to one of the brighter section of the Sonata No. 30, the first of the three that John O'Connor will be playing tomorrow night, the opening of Sonata No. 30. Opening there of Sonata No. 30 in E major, the Opus 109 of Ludwig van Beethoven. One of the three pieces that John O'Connor will be playing tomorrow night, Anders Schief, the performer in that recording that we played for you there. But for more information on registering for the Zoom symposium and to view the stream of John O'Connor's performance from the Hardiman Hotel in Galway online tomorrow night, you can visit musicforgalway.ie. A link for the performance costs a mere €12. Now, that is a treat. 3 piano sonatas from John O'Connor for just €12. A bargain, I would have thought. Poet Stephen Murphy is among the many artists contributing to RTE Illuminations, a new initiative from the Arts and Culture Department here in RTE. Artists were invited to reflect on the times we are currently living in, and contributions include works of photography, film, music, as well as written and spoken word. Stephen Murphy has written this poem for RTE Illuminations. It's called The Language of the Birds.
Sometimes, in that space between the waking world and dreaming, as I lay there on my back and I face toward the ceiling, I would try to capture meaning by the feathers of its wings, as a thought became a bird became the tune of which it sings. But no sooner had I heard it than its call had been and gone, and all it left behind it was the legacy of song that left me in the emptiness to stare at the abyss with the certainty of nothing but that momentary bliss. And for 2 full months, within that ward, I lived inside my head, with nowhere else to go besides a chair beside the bed. So I sought that bird for company, for freedom and relief, as I fought to keep my sanity, my reason and belief. And the more I trained myself to seek, became the more I saw, as the less I feigned myself to be allowed me to withdraw. Till I learned to see that certainty and permanence aren't real, and that frequency of consciousness determines how we feel. So I turned the dial from helplessness to truly tuning in, from denial through to hopefulness, and found myself begin to look beyond the prevalence of human apprehensions, to find a realm of resonance and positive intentions. And now within that space between the evening and the night, sometimes I stand upon the bridge in the fading of the light, just to watch the rise and fall of the swallows as they play, and to hear the heron's call at the closing of the day. Because in a world where isolation is synonymous with loss, and the strain of separation bears its own immoral cost, I wish I had the answers, and I wish I had the words to encapsulate the wisdom in the language of the birds.
Stephen Murphy there with his poem The Language of the Birds, and you can find out that you can find that and all of the artistic contributions in RTE Illuminations on the website rte.ie/illuminations. Roadkill is the title of the new political thriller which airs on BBC One this weekend. The drama centres around a Conservative politician and cabinet minister, Peter Lawrence, played by Hugh Laurie, who has more skeletons in his closet than the storeroom at the College of Surgeons. Mary McGill has seen episode one and is here to cast a little light on the vast intrigue that will unfold over the four episodes in total. Sorry about my skeletons in the cupboard there, Mary. We are unmistakably here in Conservative Britain, which is a Britain that has been lived in by the people of Britain for the last decade. A female Prime Minister is what we have here, however. What's the basic setup?
The basic setup is we have indeed this female Prime Minister, Prime Minister Dawn Ellison, played by a wonderfully icy Helen McCrory. And she is heading up a very conservative, as you've said, British government. And she has a transport secretary by the name of Mr. Peter Lawrence, who is our hero, so to speak, in this story, played by Hugh Laurie. Now, he is a bit of a nuisance for her at the moment, because when we meet him, he is outside a courtroom in London where the libel case that he had taken against a newspaper is after collapsing, and he's thrilled about this. The Prime Minister is not so thrilled, Sean, because this, of course, has brought unnecessary scrutiny on her government, which she does not want. But nevertheless, Peter being Peter, a man who, you know, started out in Croydon, a real Jack the Lad, and has managed to rise through the ranks to almost, but not quite, the top of the Conservative Party, at least not yet. He's pretty brazen. He's happy to do what he wants and is pretty confident that he will get to where he wants to go eventually. But the Prime Minister perhaps does not share his enthusiasm.
Well, let's listen to a scene between the said Prime Minister, Dawn Ellison, played by Helen McCrory, it has to be said, brilliantly, in the basis of the episode that I saw, although she doesn't have that much in the first episode. I'm guessing she'll have more later on. And in this scene, she is confronting the said minister, Peter Lawrence, played by Hugh Laurie.
A newspaper accused you of profiting from your time in government and lying about it. You've been found innocent. But my question is there anything else?
Is there anything else what?
Well, are there other scandals, potential scandals we need to know about, Peter?
I did SVQ.
Oh, I know, but standard vetting isn't always enough in this age of the internet. Kick a dog in the street and you can be sure some passerby has got a camera.
I don't kick dogs.
Then what do they say? It's not the lie, it's the cover-up.
Keep using that word lie.
I am asking you to shake all the skeletons out of your closet right now, and that way I can make an informed decision.
About what?
About your future.
And there we go. Dawn Ellison playing the character, Dawn Ellison rather, played by Helen McCrory, and Peter Lawrence played by Hugh Laurie in the opening episode there of Roadkill, the new BBC One drama that Mary McGill has been watching for us. Is there anything else you want to tell me, Peter?
I wrote that down, Sean. I underlined it as I was listening to it. Yeah, would you believe that there is quite a bit else that he should really be coming clean with? But he's no intention of coming clean. And this is what's fascinating. And it's fascinating to watch, actually, Hugh Laurie, who I think a lot of people consider to be quite a lovable actor in many respects, of course, Blackadder. Even House, you know, a grumpy character, but a very kind of curmudgeonly character at the same time. Very different kettle of fish is Peter Lawrence. He's almost, there's a strange absence about him when it comes to, we'll say, natural reactions to things such as shame and shock. He doesn't seem to have those kinds of capabilities, shall we say.
Just one thing before we move off Dawn Ellison. The fact that she is a female Prime Minister and a Conservative MP at that. Are there shades of Margaret Thatcher in her? Did you pick that up? Or is it kind of inevitable that we think of Margaret Thatcher when we hear of a female Tory Prime Minister? Although we could have thought of a more recent one as well.
Yes, indeed. I think the way she's costumed is very interesting, Sean. She wears a lot of ice blue, which I think is meant to convey the kind of level of iciness or, you know, level of control that she brings to her role as Prime Minister. I would say, though, that when it comes to Thatcherism, I think Peter Lawrence himself is an even purer expression of it. I mean, if there is no society and we just are individual men and women, and we ultimately only have responsibility for ourselves, as Maggie would have suggested, then he is certainly a living embodiment of that philosophy.
It's not only the Conservative Party that are up for grabs here in some ways in the Peter Lawrence character, because Hugh Laurie is heavily involved in a radio station. Is it All Talk? Yes, All Talk is the name of the radio station, with the wonderfully named Mickey the Mouth Murray.
Yes.
as the guy he kind of bounces off. So there's obviously a Nigel Farage touch here as well, is there?
There is a real kind of Jack the Lad, one of the people, never forgot my roots in Croydon element to this. And I have to say, that was one note that didn't really ring true for me. I was like, could in any parallel universe, could a Conservative Prime Minister or potential Prime Minister get away with having a kind of rough and tumble talk show where people just ring in and shoot the breeze at them? I'm not sure, but given the character that Peter Lawrence is, perhaps.
Let's go back to the College of Surgeons so and have another look in one of the other wardrobes. I mean, we meet him quite early on with his, I presume it's his mistress, because we hear mention of a wife, and what an actress we have in Cissy Babette Knudsen, former Prime Minister of Denmark, obviously in another fictional world.
Yes, that made me laugh because I'm a huge Borgen fan, and I think anyone who's a fan of political dramas will undoubtedly know Borgen. It's seen as, you know, kind of a landmark for that type of drama over the last 10 years, and that piece of casting just made me laugh because I'm like, I think tonally as well, Borgen is described as kind of politics for adults. It's not the kind of cartoonishness that you would associate, we'll say, with dramas like House of Cards. It's very much about the intrigue and the kind of chess game that is politics, and I think that there's a similar tone happening here. So yes, casting the former Prime Minister of Denmark in that role was inspired very much.
Yeah, so that's one aspect of his private life that is going to be examined, I presume, in the later episodes. His daughters, that's another set of skeletons that he has in the cupboard.
It sure is, and I'm glad you said daughters, because I mean, how many? That is the question. And we get a sense in the opening episode that one of his daughters has maybe not had the easiest life.
Yeah.
And there is kind of an irony in that he ends up with a brief that he didn't want, which is the justice brief. He thought he was going to get foreign secretary, but unfortunately it doesn't work out that way. But potentially we have a setup where the past that he has been so good at evading is going to literally crash into his world in the most profound and possibly destructive way.
Yeah, well, let's be clear. We know he has, everybody knows he has two daughters, one of whom it seems he's estranged from one of them. The other one has lots of difficulties around drug addiction and other problems as well. But then there's a potential third daughter. And if we listen to this scene, he's visiting a prison here. This is important. Is Peter Lawrence, played by Hugh Laurie. He's been told about the potential existence of a further daughter that, he says he doesn't know about, but he hasn't acknowledged, let's put it that way. And his advisor here is a guy called Duncan, played by Ian de Caskeeter, and he's bringing him to a prison where they meet an inmate called Steph Frost, played by Gibbonsola Ikomelo.
What makes you think you're my daughter?
I don't claim to be your daughter.
Then what is this?
I was sent by your daughter.
Where is she?
Not ready to meet you yet. She sent me.
She a fellow inmate? Let's be clear. I've got two daughters. They're both legitimate. I know for a fact that the younger one is studying at Leeds at the moment. I expect her to get a first-class degree in mathematics, and I've got a pretty good idea of where the older one is, too.
Yeah, where's that?
It's none of your business.
My friend reckons you were a bit of a Jack the Lad back in the 90s. Notting Hill, was it?
Yes, I lived in the Ladbroke Grove area. She could have read anywhere.
Do you remember the name of every woman you slept with?
No, do you?
Do you remember the colour of every woman you slept with?
I'm not going to have this conversation, least of all with someone I don't even know.
You know that I have something on you, or else why would you even be here?
You're not my daughter.
Did I say that I was, though?
Come on, let's go.
Yeah, not yet.
You mean not yet? Are you in on this?
And there we go. The not yet there came from the voice of the advisor, Duncan Knock, played by Ian De Castiker. And the Steph Frost character played there by Gebemisola Ikemelo, and Hugh Laurie playing the character of Peter Lawrence. That kind of sets up that there's a whole load of secrets that are going to come out of that side of thing. But I also wanted to talk about the advisors here. We're going to learn a lot more about the political advisors, which again was a touch of, there was a touch of that in Borgen, I think, as well, wasn't there? But the political advisors, if you think there's intrigue going on with the politicians, you want to see what the advisors are up to.
Yes, in the closing seconds of the opening episode, Sean, everything that's come before is effectively turned on its head. When we
don't
see
what we see.
No. But what a great way to end. But yes, yeah. I mean, the Prime Minister's right-hand woman, effectively, is Julia Bly, played by Olivia Vinal. And they are three steps ahead of Lawrence, or at least that's what it appears to be. You know, Julia is adept at, we'll say, retrieving information that could be very delicate about him. But yes, so there's all kinds of intrigue going on. But it's very, I mean, what it reminded me of was the last drama that David Hare did for television, indeed his first drama for television. Of course, he's very decorated on screen and on stage. But Collateral in 2018, where you have, you know, this it was a detective series, again, a four-part series starring Kerry Mulligan. But again, you had this stellar cast kind of set in London, sprawling all over the place. But you had all of these points of connection between the various characters. And I think he's gone back to that kind of format here. And I'm not surprised, because Collateral worked so well over those four episodes.
Yeah, and I mean, is it a 58-minute episode? Episode one. There was at least an unexpected plot twist. I would say every 10 minutes.
At least.
And all of that happening in the first episode, when you would think, oh, there has to be loads of setup here. They managed to set it up really quickly and really easily. I don't know how they did that. I suppose that's David Hare, isn't it?
It is. It's the quality of the writing and the quality of the performances and the storytelling. And I found that too. I was really struck by that. So much is going on, but it sits so well and it doesn't feel rushed. And at the same time, you understand what's going on. You're really brought into the story. So yes, very well done.
Yeah, the other thing is the relationship with the press is vitally important here, and we can boast about one of our own in this particular case. The character of Charmian Pepper, she was to be the case for the big witness for the prosecution, giving nothing away. She changes her evidence, and that's why the Laurie character gets off, and we hear that in the opening scene of the series. However, Sarah Green plays that journalist, and obviously she's in trouble, and the newspaper aren't happy because they have to fork out a load of money because of losing the case. So she's summoned Charmian is. This is Charmian is the character played by Sarah Green. She's summoned to a meeting with the newspaper proprietor, Lady Roach, played by Patricia Hodge, and the editor, Joe Lapidus, played here by Pip Torrens. And they are not at all happy with what has happened.
You've met our proprietor?
Never.
Lady Roach is down from Scotland for the day.
So you're Charmian Pepper?
We're just congratulating you on a journalistic first. We break records on this paper, and this is a record broken. Surely the most disastrous lawsuit in our history.
Joe's been wonderful. He couldn't have been more loyal, really stood by his writer.
At some cost.
I know it's bad, reputationally.
Is that a word?
But it's not going to mean hard cash, is it?
Lisa.
Insurance companies are the same as everyone else. They don't like paying.
I'm sure. Nobody pays these days unless they have to.
Even then, they don't.
But they have to pay, don't they? I mean, insurance companies are in the business of risk. Well, this lawsuit was always a risk.
How naive are you, Charmaine? I mean, you just come up the Thames on a banana boat. What is this, the 1950s? Do you think my word is my bond?
I don't think I'm naive.
I can't believe you worked as a financial journalist.
Worked?
Charmaine, you changed your story.
I know.
In court, under oath, you changed your story.
I had no choice.
You claimed Peter Lawrence was in Washington, D.C. in January 2015, collecting fees he didn't report.
I know.
But he wasn't, was he? Not according to his diary.
The diary had been altered.
Altered?
It had been tampered with.
Well, then why didn't you say that in court? Why didn't you say that?
There you go. Sarah Green is Charmaine Pepper. And Lady Rush, she is. I do beg your pardon, Lady Rush, played by Patricia Hodge. Joe Lapidus, played by Pip Torrens. He was the editor there who was clearly so annoyed. Mary McGill has been looking at the first episode of the new BBC series Roadkill starting this Sunday evening. She acquits herself really well in what is a very high-powered cast, it has to be said, does Sarah Green, doesn't she, Mary?
I think Sarah is more than capable of holding her own in any cast at this stage. She is a pleasure to watch whatever she's in. And I think where Peter Lawrence is represents a complete absence of any kind of moral centre, she is the story's moral centre. She is trying to do the right thing in a world where doing the right thing is not necessarily the easiest thing. It's certainly not the most popular thing, as we've just heard. But she really centres the story in that regard. She is the person who is trying to tell the truth.
And the other, there's a bit of intrigue around her and the legal teams as well. But again, we leave that to the viewer to discover when they watch it on Sunday evening. But one thing that I did wonder about the whole setup here, Mary. Mm. I mean, it's full of intrigue. It's full of, you know, people who are being so strategic in the moves they make and what they do and what and when they do it and what they say and to whom they say it. Have we come across any bumbling idiots in this series? You know, are there any stupid politicians? You know, not far be it for me to suggest that such a thing might exist, but are there any that we think is he or she just, you know, are they just a little bit dim? Do we get any of that sense, or is it all about intrigue? Are we missing something without that?
That is a good question. Is it all Machiavellianism? Do you know what? It is, Sean. It is. But, surely that's as old as time. I mean, we've been watching, or, you know, humans have been enjoying these stories since Shakespeare wrote them, and indeed before. It is the intrigue. It's the backstabbing. It's the people without the moral centre. It is. I mean, there was, you know, that famous study a couple of years ago that showed, you know, worrying levels of people with kind of pathological personality traits tend to go into politics and the higher echelons of business and so on. We do have a fascination with power. And I think that is what Roadkill is playing with.
All right. And I suppose the whole idea of a stupid politician, sometimes the stupidity is Machiavellian in itself. Perhaps.
And I would say, Sean, in this day and age, be careful what you wish for when it comes to stupid politicians.
You'll be watching the next three, I'm guessing.
Yes, very much so. And you know what? A welcome relief from everything that's going on, and all as it may be.
It was all done pre-COVID, so there's no sense of that. But post-Brexit, that's in there as well. However, Mary McGill there speaking to us about Roadkill, a brand new four-part political drama, Hugh Laurie in the central role, and Sarah Green, as I mentioned there too, playing the part of that journalist. The first episode airs at 9 p.m. this Sunday, October the 18th on BBC One Television. No More Time is the new collection from Greg Delante, a poet born in Cork and now based in Vermont since the mid-1980s. Colin McCann has called him the laureate of those who have gone. These latest poems salute the natural world and are especially dedicated to all of those who work to slow climate change. Greg Delante joins me now from Vermont. Given what Colin McCann says there, Greg, about you, the laureate of those who have gone, a title like No More Time, are you worried that there will be even more gone before too long if we don't change our ways?
Sean, they're going already. I mean, today, practically every day now, there's an animal or plant going extinct, you know, and they're all connected ultimately to everything else. So that means the other creatures and plants and people will be affected. and then the climate change on top of that, which is all part of the whole thing. That's what the book was about. That's what the book is set against. There's no point then for me in not facing it. And I live a life too. You know, I've changed my life, my own way to try and adapt. And you can't, I mean, putting my poems where my mouth is, you know what I mean? I have no solar on the house here in the home in Ireland, the solar going in, and I cycle all, I gave up my car 5 years, I cycle everywhere, even do snowstorms to work. And, you know, I mean, I get carbon offsets when I travel, and I try, but with the new thing, the new COVID thing, then there's not much travel anyway. But anyway, you know, it is for sure trying to witness really all that's happening and give some hope, but real hope rather than making it up just for the sake of hope, you know.
It's interesting what you say about extinction, because in your preface to the book, you actually, the very first sentence, or two sentences in fact, read, extinction is a natural phenomenon. It occurs as a natural, quote, background, unquote, rate of about 1 to 5 species per year. So 1 to 5 species per year would be the natural way. What is happening at the moment, Greg?
Human beings, fossil fuels, etc., the amount, the population of human beings, it's nearly 8 million now, is affecting the natural world. And that means that in all the various ways, they'll all have their own particular ways of affecting us, the animals and plants and so forth. But there's thousands going extinct now at that rate, rather than 4 or 5 every year. Every year there's thousands going extinct because of the way we're living in the world. And that's different than the natural. And that's going to affect us eventually as well, and our children in the future. And this is, I mean, we got to face it, you know. I mean, we can't just, I mean, I know the COVID and everything is terrible. And the COVID actually gives us a hope, because somehow the COVID, we seem to have reacted in a worldwide way. And so we're going to have to do the same with our fossil fuels and stop using them, really.
Yes, as you say, so we're looking at the current rate, scientists will tell us, is about between 1,000 and 10,000. So thousands of species disappearing every week, dozens go extinct every day. Let's listen to one of the poems, because if this particular species becomes totally extinct, we are in big trouble. Honeybee is the poem that you might read for me, Greg.
May I say something about the poem for a moment? The main the book is broken into 3 parts, and the main sequence is called A Field Guide to People, and it's made up of 26 sonnets, one for every letter of the alphabet, suggesting all of nature, I suppose, and us. It's also written in Terzarima's style, harkening back to the world, the underworld of that Dante created, except that I'm putting the animals and plants into the underworld, suggesting that Christianity has very much at fault at distancing us from the natural world, apart from someone like St. Francis. So I'm suggesting that there. But there are love poems too, because there's a couplet at the end and there's sonnets. Anyway, but it's important for me that the structure is acknowledged, as well as what's been said in the poems, because we're going to have to change our structure. Anyway, this is to a poet, a Greek poet, who gave me honey from Spelea in Greece, and the Delphic bee was the women who made prophecy at Delphi. Honeybee. It is time. Anoint thy tongue with honey. Local thyme honey from Spelea, a gift from the Greek poet Caligaris, amusedly musing, honey to give your words wing lift. Back in the day, it was taken by the Delphic bee. Wake up, get busy, make a move, a shift. Apply propolis pronto. Impossible not to be a drama queen nowadays. Without Apis, the abbess will take over. Unbloom many a garden, field and wood. The honeybees are more waning than waxing, warns apiology. Queens, drones, nurses, guards, whole communities. Protect them. The amber labour force of ecology. Already this work comb is a fossilised apology.
That's Greg Delante reading his poem Honeybee from his latest collection, No More Time. I get the sense that is almost a type of a prayer, or is it a cry? Is it a de profundis type of cry that you're making there, Greg?
It's everything, I suppose, really. It's me just I say it's a kind of prayer. It is, yes. I can't, you know, it should be doing different things at the same time. It's hard for me to say what exactly it is, you know.
You're going through your alphabet as you do in that opening section, and you get as far as M when you interrupt us with part two, breaking news. This struck me as perhaps a more political part of the book. Was that in your mind, or what was that break about?
Well, the whole thing is political, really, by the acknowledgement of the natural world and how we're treating it and how we're in it. But you didn't. Yes, it was. The middle poems then were literally breaking news, how we must change, things we can do, things we should do, things I have done, and so forth. So, as far as I'm concerned, like the academic or the poet or whoever in the ivory tower is much good right now. I mean, you have to make sense and you have to make action out of your knowledge. You know, I mean, it's terrible not to do that for me. We're all so lucky, really, in the Western world, but we're sitting on our asses, a lot of us. I mean, we could all do more. I could do more, you know.
If we were to change, if you were to change one thing, or if you were to advise people on one thing they might change, is there one that you think would help more than others?
Oh, dear. I do copy there now, really. I mean, coal and oil, the cars, try and limit your driving in your car. I mean, I gave up my car, so as I say, I cycle everywhere. And actually, you know what? I've changed my life and I kind of dreaded it. But now even in snowstorms, I cycle into the middle of the town and I put my bike on the front in the middle of winter in Vermont, which is severe. It can go below 40. But I tell why I'm saying this is that actually I like it. I found that it's actually, I don't have to deal with car insurance, I don't have to deal with getting petrol, I don't have to deal with all the crap that goes with having a car, you know. And we think we won't be able to do it, but we can do a lot of the time without them. If you're living in rural parts and if you have children, perhaps it's different. But, I mean, we can get electric, the electric world, the whole thing has been held up also by the industry, you know.
Might go to another poem in that breaking news section, Greg. And this is an acrostic. I don't know if you can really help us here. I'd rather not say what the acrostic is to start out. People might listen carefully to the opening letter of each word at the beginning of each line here. Five lines in the first stanza, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the second stanza. It's a name, and the person's second name is in the first stanza and their first name is in the second stanza. Will you read it for us on viewing the roses of Heliogabalus?
I will, yeah. You were talking in the last book. I enjoyed the piano concerto with John O'Connor, which I love. I love the emperor and so forth. And the last person was talking about the foolish, nutty, but clever politicians. And this is probably the main one in the whole world right now. And we know who. But it's called, I was looking at the roses of Hege, I can't even say it, but I can't say the other fellow's name either, Heliogabalus, and this terrible emperor in Rome at the time, he was worse than Nero, nearly, he did dreadful things. And there is an epigraph, Emperor Heliogabalus and his cronies sought to confound the order of seasons and climates, to sport with passions and prejudices of his subjects, and subvert every law of nature and decency. Anyway, there you are. That's a quote from Edward Gibbon. And the poem itself is, the emperor and his hobnobbing retinue recline on the high dais. Everyone gazes up at them from the floor. He winks to his chosen few, mutters, watch this for a trap, hollers, let's play, bring on the grand finale. Drinks his cup, a sign to drop the false ceiling of flowers on everyone below. You can feel nauseating petals catching noses and crying throats, levels rapidly rising, drowning everyone in pink roses.
Greg Delante with his poem on viewing the roses of Heliogabalus, and the is the first word in the first line, recline, up, mutters, play. They're the first letters, or the first words in those lines, so you can work out.
Let's hope he'd become less known after the elections. Yeah.
You can see it much clearly when we look down on the page, I think, for sure on that. I was really struck by a title in particular. This is a poem that you translated from Sean O'Reardon, a title, Apathy Is Out. It really is. That's part of what you're saying in the book as well. No More Time. Apathy is not a runner here for us, is what you're saying essentially, Greg.
Ah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a fabulous poem. I think it's a breakthrough poem from in the 20th century, middle of the 20th century. That actually, this book is, I'm doing a whole book of translations that will come out of Auréon next year. And that's the title of the book, actually. Auréon saw that we're all connected. Whereas the start of the 20th century, a lot of the artists, and we all saw ourselves fragmented and so forth. He saw we were together and we saw the natural, we need everything. And that's what that poem was. I mean, I can read it, but maybe it's no time now.
No, we can't get to it now. Yeah. We don't have time to do that. What you might finish up by reading for me is one of the shorter poems in the book, which is simply called S.
S, here we go. I leave this to your, what this is about. I've lost it.
Page 34.
Two lines. With the snaky handle of just one letter, the word, unsheathed from its scabbard, becomes sword.
Lovely. And on the page opposite that, you have a sentence in the shape of a cross. You like the shaping of a line on the page as much as anything else, Greg, it struck me.
Yeah, I mean, the structure itself involves the meaning. So I like playing around and giving it, and being appropriate in tandem with the meaning in sync. Yeah.
Well, thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Greg Delanty, and his new collection of poems called No More Times is published by Louisiana State University Press, simply known as LSU Press. And that is our lot for this evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was by Mark McGrath. And tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RTÉ Radio 1.